Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I got two important guests. One is a Chapel Hill guy, and one is one's formerly the chancellor of the university, but still a Chapel Hill guy. Holden Thorpe and Buck Goldstein have written their second book together, and it's called Our Higher Calling. It's about higher education and the problems of higher education that we face today. In case you don't remember, Holden Thorpe is now at Washington University in St. Louis, where he is the, help me with this, Holden, Rita
Levy Montalcini,
Distinguished University Professor of Chemistry and Medicine. And of course, Buck Goldstein, we know, is a professor of practice and university entrepreneur in residence, Department of Economics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And these two are friends. You guys wrote your first book kind of together starting out here, didn't you?
Yes.
What was that book about, real quickly, because we want to move to your second book?
So it's really about how entrepreneurial thinking and innovation can allow the university to have a greater impact on the world.
And we wrote it at a time when lots of universities were thinking about doing more to promote entrepreneurship through their programs, and ever since we wrote it, that has only intensified.
It was at the beginning of a real role for entrepreneurship. Were you all concentrating mainly in your book in terms of entrepreneurship as course material or discipline material for the students at the university, or for ways in which university administrators should be looking at their jobs?
Both.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that certainly at the time there were lots of universities figuring out how to launch entrepreneurship programs, because it kind of falls in a strange place between the business school and the rest of the university. Business schools traditionally haven't taught entrepreneurship. Some of them have started to get into it over the last 20 years or so. And so lots of universities were trying to decide how to do that, including UNC Chapel Hill and WashU launched an entrepreneurship center around the same time. But, you know, there was also a lot of interest picking up with regard to how universities could start companies and how entrepreneurs like Buck could re-engage with their alma mater.
And you.
could re-engage with their alma mater. And so, you know, we put down some things that help people think about that.
But I'm really glad you asked, though, because it's a great segue. We wrote this book. And
you're talking about the first book.
The first book. Mm-hmm. And people would uniformly come up to us and say, independently, they would say, we loved your first book. We couldn't agree more. We need to start running the university like a corporation. Mm. And finally, one day, Holden called and said, we've got to write another book.
But I mean, a lot of people say this, and they say it with all the good intentions, but you disagree with that.
That's why we wrote the book.
Disagree more passionately, yeah. And that's why we wrote the second book.
Well, before we leave entrepreneurship, let me ask you about one thing that I'm interested in. But when I was coming along beginning when I was a student, and then all the way through the times that I was working with the university, it was leadership that was kind of except at ROTC, it was not a part of the regular curriculum of the university. And people were saying, we've got to teach these guys to be leaders. And there were leadership training things, and there still are, and it's really good. But then entrepreneurship kind of came in, and all of a sudden, it was entrepreneurship, which we needed to somehow figure out how to give our students and others an opportunity to be trained in entrepreneurship.
Well, it's really a way of thinking, and if at its bottom, leadership is more, I think, perceived at least as talking, and entrepreneurship is more like listening.
I want to just talk about that some.
And just back to the university, I mean, you cannot, yes, it's true that entrepreneurship has become part of sort of the thing that universities like to say they're doing, but I don't think leadership has receded. I mean, you would be hard-pressed to pull down the case statement of a university fundraising campaign or a mission statement that doesn't say we train leaders. Every university is saying that they train leaders. And so I think that's probably still there. But I think that entrepreneurship became, you know, as the dot-com thing got going and biotech started being something important, people started looking to universities to catalyze it. I think that's just kind of where the whole thing comes from.
I agree. But the listening part is really the so when we train entrepreneurs, we train them to begin by thinking about who the customer, okay, and who are we trying to impact. And so if you start there and you build whatever you're going to build based on listening really, really carefully to the needs, and expectations, it's a different model than we know what's right and we're going to tell everybody what's right. And frankly, I think the big picture, that is beginning, people are beginning to understand that our leaders need to do a lot more listening and a lot less talking. And I think at the bottom, our book feels the same way, which is if we're going to rebuild this partnership, then we have to have some humility and we have to do some listening, especially the academy needs to spend more some time listening.
So you're taking us into your book now, and let's talk about it. Our Higher Calling, and then you got the long subtitle, mm-hmm. Rebuilding the Partnership Between America and Its Colleges and Universities. And so is it the universities that need to be as entrepreneurs? Is that what you're saying, that we need, that universities need to be listening more?
Go ahead.
Yes. Well, I think that what we're really saying is that for quite some time, and certainly at least since the Morrill Act of 1862.
Yeah. Most people in Chapel Hill and certainly people in North Carolina State know what you're talking about.
The Morrill Act was an act that was signed by Abraham Lincoln that created the land-grant universities. And that's probably the most conspicuous time where the American federal government staked its claim with regard to the higher education system by funding through the land grants many great American research universities, including North Carolina State, but also all over the country. And if you read the Morrill Act, it's quite illuminating because it basically spells out this idea that the federal government would provide this support in exchange for the universities carrying out important scholarship, but most importantly, teaching young people in the useful arts, it says.
First of all, neither of you are now associated with the land grant institution.
No, it's true.
Although, as you point out in your book, it infects the whole higher education enterprise. One of the debates that you all raise in your books is what is the purpose of the university, and is it to give grounding for all its graduates in terms of being in the liberal arts to be able to get along in this world and be leaders and to be contributors and to be just broad-based general education, or as in the Morrill Act, to train people to be contributors in their profession or jobs, or to be able to work and make a living?
I can tell you, if you ask a student or their parents what is the purpose of university when they enter in UNC, the 85 to 90% will tell you to get a job. And that is the uniformly. Now, I'm not saying that is the only purpose of the university, but if you begin to listen as well as talk, our constituency feels very strongly that teaching, essentially, is a critical part of what we do. And when we talk to leaders, really the most persuasive ones say, if you're doing a great job teaching and your students love the teaching and the parents love the teaching, you can get a long, long, long way with that kind of capital that you build up with great teaching.
But it still sounds like an ambiguous.
I think, so here's a better, a more concise way of saying it. So we're not saying that universities should retool themselves so that to become, you know, very, very intentional teachers of trades. But we are saying that we need to recognize the fact that most people out there who aren't part of the academic community believe that the most important thing we do is prepare people to get jobs. And so we can go along telling ourselves we're here to teach people that knowledge is timeless and that critical thinking is sublime and all the things that we value. But we can't at the same time say that while the outside world is saying to us, but we're sending you our students so that they can get good jobs when they get out. This is creating a lot of the problems that we believe we're seeing are because we haven't reckoned with this disconnect. And what happens is, you know, people like me who are, I'm a provost or my friends who are chancellors, they'll go talk to the legislators and the policymakers and say, don't worry, we're training kids to get a good job. You can trust us with that. And then they'll go to the faculty council meeting and say, don't worry, we got you covered when it comes to academic freedom and tenure and shared governance and all this stuff. And the truth is that that's catching up with us because we don't live in a world where you can tell a different narrative to two different audiences because information is being shared perfectly. And it probably wasn't a good idea to begin with to have two different stories, but for sure now we can't get away with it any longer. So what we're asking people to do is to think about the fact that this disconnect is out there and start struggling with what we're going to do to try to bring these two groups together.
Well, if you joined us late, you've been listening to our former chancellor, Holden Thorpe, who together with his colleague, Buck Goldstein, has a new book, Our Higher Calling. The group of us will be right back to talk about that book after this short break. If y'all are ready, we'll just keep going.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Holden Thorpe, the former chancellor of the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and now the provost and professor, distinguished professor of chemistry at Washington University in St. Louis, and his friend and colleague, Buck Goldstein, writing their second book, Our Higher Calling. And Buck, before the break, we were in the middle of talking about this really fundamental problem that universities have in explaining to their constituencies what they're really
right.
about. And is it a jobs training training and education for particular jobs, or is it something else in terms of giving people, preparing people, as Tom Rawls used to say, not for their first job, but for their fifth and sixth
yes.
and seventh job?
In fact, the average college graduate will have 20 different jobs. Mm. During their career now.
So what is it?
Well, it's both. It's not either or, it's both and. So the obligation to teach and to help students be career ready, and frankly, to the extent that we can help students be career ready, we give them the ability to be an English major or a history major. And one of the things that some very great schools, including your school, Wake Forest, does.
I just have to say, it's like Wake Forest, but it's called Davidson.
Oh, sorry.
And I'll tell you, I compliment either way.
But Wake Forest does an amazing job of, from the very beginning, on the first day of freshman orientation, telling parents, look, we've got the job thing covered. So don't worry if your kid's a history major or an English major or a religion major, because we're from day one going to focus on making sure that when they're done with their history or their English or whatever they choose to pursue, that they are job ready.
How do they – I agree with that. But how do they explain that to the parents that I'm taking a course mm-hmm. In Renaissance literature mm-hmm. and about which I will remember not very much mm-hmm. Two or three years from now. Mm-hmm. How does that liberal education prepare me for these 20 jobs you say?
Well, what they do at Wake Forest and a lot of – certainly we're trying to do it at Washington University and a lot of other places – is that we have – try to get students to come in. And it's a struggle because they – to them 4 years seems like a long time. So getting them to come at the very beginning – to start talking about what happens when they get out is something we have to work at. But if we can get folks to come in when their first year or even second year and start talking to us about what internships they want to have in the summer or mm-hmm. do they want to have an internship during the school year, that gives us the opportunity to try to make sure that, as Chris Newfield, who's a faculty critic of higher education that we quote extensively in the book, says, you know, if you can make it academically connected, then it has much more potential to fulfill an objective. But just to tell you kind of how acute this is, I mean, you've probably go, lots of people in Chapel Hill go to events where students introduce themselves, and they nowadays every student has two majors. Well, the reason they have two majors is they have one for themselves and one for their parents. So when they get up and say, I'm a theater and accounting major, then we know they're really passionate about theater, but their parents have told them they have to get an accounting degree. Nothing against accounting. If you love that, of course, it's great. But what we are advocating is, you know, if we do this right, it's fine to just be a theater major, but if the university does its job in helping figure out how to connect that to the things that you want to do, then you can still have a fulfilling career when you get out. And in the long run, that's good for theater, because it does, it says you can still be a theater major and get a good job when you get out, rather than saying, well, if you're a theater major, you're going to have to pick up the second major in accounting.
So the hard part about the book is what we assert is that this wonderful ideal of the university involves both wonderful opportunities and significant obligations. And that's the key. Many of our colleagues, because no one's ever articulated before to say, okay, you love the academic freedom, you love the shared governance, you love being among your colleagues in this great, fabulous place, but there's a deal here, and that there are obligations that faculties have in order to get to be in that position. And on the other side, it's not free. And so for those people who say, gee, we're doing great science, we're going to cure cancer, all that, well, that requires funding. And so it's those obligations that we are the most difficult part of the conversation right now.
You, in your subtitle of your book, Our Higher Calling, you talk about a partnership. And so what are the obligations of the university as a part of that partnership to the to the public at large?
Well, if you go back to, as we were talking about the Morrill Act before, and then you look through the end of World War II, a very smart person named Vannevar Bush wrote a paper called Science, the Endless Frontier, which was used, started by FDR, but then used by President Truman to establish the federal funding for science. And at the same time, the GI Bill became a very important way for lots of students to go to college. And then after that, we had the federal aid for financial aid, the Pell Grant. And so if you look over this entire course of this history, the good news is that the federal government is saying time and time again that higher education and really a liberal education is the antecedent to all the great things that the country wants. So the federal government has been saying over the course of this entire time that we believe we want to subsidize higher education because we believe it's the good of the country. Now, if you read through all of the legislation and documents and everything that create all this, you see that there are things like science in the national interest, science that drives the economy, a skilled workforce that's able to carry out technical jobs. These are many, many different expectations that the federal government has put out there over time. And as I was saying earlier, we do offer some suggestions at the end about how to deal with this, but the main thing we want is for people to realize that there's a set of expectations there on each side, and they've never really been reconciled. So what we do in the book is we spend the first part of the book saying to people in the outside world, here are the things that are indispensable to the university. So we have a chapter called Students Are Not Customers, Faculty Are Not Employees. We don't believe faculty are employees. They're management. And we talk about tenure and academic freedom and shared governance and students learning timeless things in the liberal arts and how important they are. Then we spend the second half of the book talking about the things that the public expects, world-class medical care and research, getting jobs for students, commercializing inventions that drive the economy. And what we think can be just the most powerful act in the world is if each side would ask the other side to help with this. So, for example, you know, if I'm a faculty member who reads our book, I might say, okay, well, this is all great, except that when you hired me, nobody told me I was supposed to be finding jobs for my students and commercializing inventions. You told me I was supposed to come here and teach and pursue the truth wherever it leads. And then if you're on the other side, it's easy to say, well, you told me when I supported you that you were going to do all these things for me. And, you know, we've just come to the point now where we've got to try to bring these things together.
If you joined us late, we're listening to, you're just listening to our former Chancellor Holden Thorpe, now at Washington U in St. Louis. And we're also hearing from his co-author of Our Higher Calling, Buck Goldstein. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about a brand new book written by two people with Chapel Hill connections. It's called Our Higher Calling, Rebuilding the Partnership Between America and Its Colleges and Universities, written by Holden Thorpe and Buck Goldstein. You're trying to tell us, Holden, when we took the break, that the university is not doing a good job not only with explaining its purpose to the outside world, but that the people who run the university don't understand these responsibilities, that the faculty members are recruited without being told that they have an obligation that goes beyond just teaching and finding the truth.
Well, look, university administrators, and certainly I've been guilty of this in all the roles that I've had, we like to share good news and tell people things they want to hear. So when we hire faculty, we talk about academic freedom and tenure and pursuing the truth. When we go to Raleigh and try to get money, we talk about driving the economy and getting jobs for students. And, you know, we haven't shared those two narratives as much as we should have across both sides. Same thing, you know, in a way, when we talk about all the great things that are going on at the university, we don't talk about all the problems very often. And so what happens is that because people are used to just hearing good news from us, they don't necessarily believe it all because it all sounds too good to be true. And what's happened is, over the last 20 years especially, a lot of critics of higher education have been able to fill the void with critique of higher education, and there aren't as many people who are proponents of higher education who are able to make the case, partly because we've sort of lost people because they get all of our shiny brochures where everyone's smiling and all the discoveries are worthy of a Nobel Prize and there are no problems going on. And so, you know, we think that because information is so easily accessible and shared now, that we have to take up the mantle of having a story that is more coincident with what's really going on. And so are the people who leading universities not saying, you know, not telling everybody everything? Yes, but there's good reasons for all that. And it's just time to turn the battleship a little more towards folks saying, you know, what it is that we're really, really dealing with.
In your book, you describe it at length and with some in some specificity, some of the things that the universities and their leaders are not doing that they need to do in order to fulfill their part of this partnership.
Right. So one is that universities have certainly since the GI Bill have been the front door to the middle class. In the current environment we're in, students in the top income quartile in this country are eight times more likely to get a college degree than students in the bottom quartile. And so, if anything, no matter how hard we've worked, we found that we're actually falling behind in terms of diversity. Well, that's a depending where you stand, either a moral problem or a political problem, but it's now becoming an economic problem because we've run out of the traditional students who used to be four-year residential people who came to university and then graduated and went on. They're not only are they all taken, but they're being competed for like crazy. So as of last May, only 38% of the colleges and universities had fulfilled their admissions target for the for that year, only 38%.
For overall?
Yeah.
Not for any particular category, but their overall.
For undergraduates.
So
only 38% had even gotten enough applicants they could accept to meet their expectations for the year. So suddenly, everything's changing because...
I wasn't prepared for this. I'm really sorry. You're going to have to help me.
All right.
So does this mean that they're now including public universities in our massive, that there are many vacancies in the undergraduate...
Yes. I mean, it's hard for people in Chapel Hill to get this because they always hear about... I don't know what Carolina is up to 35,000 or maybe even more. I haven't looked lately, applications. And... there's always such a thing about, you know, who doesn't get in and a lot about that. So, you know, a school like Carolina is not in this group. But if you look at all of American higher education, you include the urban public universities and the geographically isolated liberal arts colleges. And remember, not every geographically isolated liberal arts college is like Davidson. A lot of them are small places that are hard to get to. So most of these schools, as Buck is saying, are not able to meet the enrollment targets that they have. And that's because partly the demography in terms of the number of 18-year-olds that there are in the country, but also in terms of the economic status of the 18-year-olds that are out there. There aren't as many students who can pay tuition that are 18 years old.
Yeah, well, a lot of the smaller campuses that you describe, just because of the economics of it, have to charge a high tuition, and they, in part, have priced themselves out of a smaller market.
Well, that's the other myth. A large percentage of the colleges in this country right now, no one on the campus pays the published rate.
Right, but it is still expensive.
It's perceived as being very expensive.
No, I mean, it is expensive.
It depends on the place. It can be, yeah.
But I guess get into the bottom of it with my problem, which is I want you all to say forthrightly that we have an oversupply of overall, we have more places in undergraduate curriculum than there are people who want to take.
Well, there's
these
a mismatch. It's kind of, I would call it more of a mismatch than oversupply, because at the same time that we have schools that can't make their enrollment targets, as a country, we're falling behind in terms of the number of people in our population who have a degree past high school. So, but they're in some cases, they're just in the wrong place. I mean, if you're a college in Maine, your demographic and the demographic is growing in Texas and in California and in the Southwest and even in the South, you're in the wrong spot.
Sure. I think those are important problems for us, that the isolated campuses and the struggling small campuses, that is an important problem. But the main problem that you're making me wrestle with is that that you're telling me that we don't have enough people signing up to go to college as should sign up.
We aren't addressing the needs. Okay, if you start with the customer and you listen, we aren't addressing the needs as well as we could of a whole segment of the population who, if we don't learn how to educate them, we're going to internationally, we're going to fall behind.
Yeah, I agree.
Here's the problem. It's not that we don't have, that we have too many slots in absolute terms. It's that there's a lot of people out there who either don't know that they could attend and complete college or feel that it's out of range for them economically, or in many cases it may well be out of range for them economically. But if you look, for example, one thing that surprises people is if you ask, you know, what are the hottest schools in the country? Well, the public universities that are in southern cities with growing populations, Atlanta, Georgia, Tampa, Florida, Orlando, Florida, Miami, Florida, so Georgia State, USF, UCF, FIU, these schools are growing by leaps and bounds. They're innovating in terms of how to get their students graduated, and they're in places where the population is growing, and therefore, if they make college available at a competitive price, they can get lots of people enrolled, and that's making a huge difference in the country.
Well, we need to take a break. I'm in the middle of, I need to calm down. Y'all have got me really worried. And the reason I'm worried is that we're talking with Holden Thorpe, our former chancellor, and Buck Goldstein, our friend and local Chapel Hillian, about their book, Our Higher Calling, Rebuilding the Partnership Between America's Colleges and Universities, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Holden Thorpe and Buck Goldstein about their second book, Together, Our Higher Calling, Rebuilding the Partnership Between America and Its Colleges and Universities. And you guys, I'm loaded. I got to stop asking you questions. What have we missed, Holden, about this book and the kinds of things that you all wanted to convey to the rest of us, your readers?
Well, one of the things that we really got quite attached to, and initially we thought would be controversial with our faculty colleagues, but as we've talked about it with many folks, we found that actually this is a very resonant message, is that the teaching function of especially research universities is incredibly important. And sometimes at research universities, star faculty don't teach very much, or they go into administration and stop teaching. And we make a case in there that everybody should teach, we like to say, with abandon. And
You just came out and said everybody should teach, and some people argue with you and say, gosh, some of these guys, it's good to have them behind the desk.
Sure, but if that's true, then those folks really need to think about their place in the community quite carefully, because the public views, a large segment of the public views teaching as the most important, if not only, thing that the university does, and these big buildings with labs in them, they don't ask too many questions about what goes on in there. And there are plenty of good reasons why star faculty aren't teaching if they're getting grants and things, but we believe we've reached a point where the public doesn't care about that anymore. So trying to explain to somebody, oh yeah, well this is why this star faculty doesn't faculty member doesn't teach anymore, or why this administrator, even though he's the chancellor or the provost, doesn't teach anymore, that the public their eyes are glazing over, and we're trying to explain that. And a much easier thing would be if we just said to everybody, hey, didn't you come here because you want to help students succeed in the world?
Well, you were having to say, that works. Now you've been there long enough so that you can have your colleagues say that to incoming faculty. Does it work?
Yeah, it works. And I this year when we oriented the new faculty, I got up and made this speech quite passionately. And all the department chairs were there, and I was expecting to get a bunch of static afterwards. And don't worry, in an environment like mine, faculty giving static to the administrators is not something they feel sheepish about doing. But instead, no, people were excited and I think relieved, because a lot of people really do join universities because they want to be great teachers. And when somebody says, hey, it's okay for you to spend time and energy on that, that's a relief and makes them feel good about the thing that they've signed up to do.
Well, the other thing is, how do you run a university or play any major role in a university if you're not involved with students? So, and having lunch with a student group once a month is not involved with students. What's involved in students was a student who today came by because she had an accident and needed to take an exam that was last Thursday, and Holden and I were working on some stuff, and she came by, gave her the exam, they proctored it. We proctored it over in another adjoining office, and I said to Holden, you know, if you're not giving grades, if you're not really engaged, you're not really engaged with students. And Holden, here, they told him he didn't have time to teach, and we taught together, a great big class, and he said, yeah, I think I can make time to teach. And once he did it, he didn't have to tell other people to do it. If he does it, and if leaders do it, if the top person in every university in this country taught a class, everybody would be teaching a class.
Well, y'all, we're coming to the end of the time that we got together, and you got me so worried about our universities and their partnership with the public. Do we have a chance to either rescue or reinvigorate our universities so that they serve the needs of the public as it is today and will be in the next few years?
We wouldn't have written this book, and I wouldn't get up and go to work every day if I didn't believe that universities have the power to transform the world, both in terms of the students that get their education and the knowledge that we create. What we think is that now's the time to think about this in a different way, where instead of having the inside and outside of the university believing different things, it's time to get everybody to believe in one story about the future of higher education. And that's a lot of work to do that. It requires people to understand deep details about who gets into college and how much they pay and how the economics of everything works and where these universities are and how they're funded. And it's a very complicated system. But we're asking people, we wrote a short book so that people wouldn't be asked for an unreasonable amount of time to let us teach them a few important details about American universities that will help them to join us in creating this shared understanding of what higher education is all about.
Buck, you mentioned earlier that some people got the wrong message from your entrepreneurship message, that the university should be run by people who would run it like a business. You have people on boards who are of that mind. Is your book going to be valuable for them?
I hope so, and I think so. Early returns are people who, all across the political spectrum, the biggest surprise so far is that people who seem to agree on nothing have liked our book. And so I think we've satisfied ourselves that there is common ground, more common ground than I think we thought when we started the book, because some of the people who've written blurbs or other things, we never would have dreamed we could get that kind of support for it. So now it's a question of continuing the conversation. And that's our goal now. We see the book as a conversation starter, not a conversation finisher. And we begin even as recent, currently as today, later this afternoon, with a community meeting in Chapel Hill of faculty, board of trustees, students, and we're going to have mostly conversation with them and see how it goes, but we're optimistic.
I'm glad you're optimistic, and I'm wondering whether or not, like when you wrote your first book, came to see problems. Have you come to see problems that are going to require a third book? Are you thinking about other things that you need to address?
I promised I wasn't going to write the second book until Holden said we have to write the second book because...
Yeah, there's a reason I needed to write the book with Buck, because the whole point behind the book is that it's a dialogue between a career academic and somebody who was in the private sector for most of his life. And so I'll write these long things about academic freedom and something like that, and Buck will write back, I don't really want to know all that. And then we have to work
I'm not that diplomatic.
You said it in a nice way.
You know what I said? I said, who cares?
Yeah, okay. I was giving a little too much credit, but that's okay. So then, you know, we struggle through coming to a common understanding of that, and that's really what we're asking people to do when they read the book.
Well, I thank you for your book and for the usefulness that it will have for all of us who have an interest in supporting higher education to understand from two people who've really thought about it what our challenges are and some of the ways that we can meet those challenges. So Holden Thorpe and Buck Goldstein, congratulations on your book, Our Higher Calling, Rebuilding the Partnership Between America and Its Colleges and Universities. And Holden, if you can't come back to talk about books, we hope we can figure out some other way to make you come back more often.
It's always great to be here, DG.
Thanks, Buck.
Thank you.
Thanks to all y'all for listening. This is DG Martin, who's talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.